real life. So.
All right, good. And how many folks here are within less than 3 years at tenure track appointment? Is there anybody who's less than 3 years at tenure track appointment? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so you guys are potentially going to be eligible, or you will be eligible for the program I'll talk about. For other folks who are past third year, we're making a transition with the Research Corporation programs, and you guys, it's going to be important for you to communicate to your colleagues and be mentoring your colleagues. So I still think it's relevant what I'm going to be talking about. But also, what I'd like to do is mostly be having a discussion, so certainly we can have questions, and I'm going to ask you guys to answer questions. And I want to concentrate some on how you can write effective grants. And if you're a fantastic grant writer, that's great, but I also think this is the kind of stuff that needs to be communicated to junior colleagues and to help mentor them. And I'm going to approach it somewhat from the perspective of being at a small private foundation, research corporation, what we look for, but I think a lot of the themes that I'm going to talk about translate across programs, but of course I cannot say specifically what another foundation is looking for, but I do feel that there's some pretty strong themes that you want to think about whenever you're writing a grant, and we can talk about some of those things today. Okay, so.
Rich, there may also be a few people, one of whom apparently is not here yet, who have not yet reached the tenure track level.
Right.
They're teaching in non-tenure tracks at PUOS.
Right. So, right, if they become tenure track, then they can become eligible for our specific programs. And of course, there's lots of other foundations and potential programs as well. So you guys are always welcome to communicate with me. We try to be very friendly. And I know that a lot of people in this, or some of the people in this room I've talked with before, and our website has definitely got a lot of information on it. And I'm not going to try to recreate the information of our website because that's not a really good use of my time. So a lot of specific details you can look up. So this is our official mission. It sounds a little redundant. Research Corporation for Science Advancement, its mission is to advance science. But particularly we're looking for early stage, high potential, basic scientific research. So we rarely, if ever, fund anything that's very applied. Our emphasis is on basic fundamental research, and that's probably something that's of interest to most of the people here. That's mostly what I think the people in here are working on. There may be some applied projects that you guys have, I don't know. So that's good. And what we do is provide catalytic funding, and we sponsor conferences, grants. We also do some advocacy. Our focus is on early career faculty, innovative ideas. We're very much interested in integrating research and teaching, and that's good because I think that's a focus of PUIs, primarily undergraduate institutions. We also like to support collaborative and multidisciplinary research, and we're very interested in affecting the academic cultures. That's something that's important to us, both the academic cultures at the research universities and at the primarily undergraduate institutions. And we do have a history of making a difference and really changing a lot of the culture at undergraduate institutions over decades of funding, both from Research Corporation and other foundations that share some of our goals. So just if you guys aren't familiar with us, we were founded by Frederick Gardner Cottrell 103 years ago. We operate with a private endowment. We fund chemistry, physics, and astronomy almost exclusively. And there's a picture of Fred. And you got to admit, he was a pretty handsome guy. Okay. So our focus, again, maybe it's a little redundant, but we want to partner with universities and colleges to provide this early career funding. So one of the things that we're concerned about is what's the environment that we're going to potentially fund in, what's the quality of the institution, are they supporting research, and are they somebody that are going to be a good partner? We don't provide the majority of what somebody needs. The majority always comes from their home institution in all sorts of ways, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But, you know, we want to make sure that we're doing a good partnership. We're not going to fund somebody at a place where there isn't really support for them to be successful. And we're very interested in the integration of research and education. Okay, and then I thought this is interesting. I looked at the list of speakers for this conference, and these are all folks that have been funded by Research Corporation. Bill won the APS Prize for PUI faculty. We initiated and sponsored that prize starting in 1985 or 86 with the idea that there needed to be recognition for faculty at primarily undergraduate institutions on a national level, and then that would help encourage high-quality research at PUIs. So this is something we've been interested in for decades. We have no role in the selection. We simply provide the funding for the APS Prize, and then the APS administers and selects. And then we've also, through our Cottrell College program, we have funded, unless I made a mistake, we funded all of these folks here, and I hope I didn't miss anyone. And these are just the people that were listed as speakers who are there. So I would argue that we have definitely helped this community significantly. We have been interested in this community, and we've been a consistent supporter in the context of the college program, because we're interested in high-quality research at colleges, and we do not have any bias against theoretical research. We think that that is a great area to fund, and we have consistently tried to fund that. And I see there's several people on that list who are in this room right now. Okay, good. So with apologies to Tolkien, one program to rule them all. Nobody else is laughing, so I guess we don't have any Tolkien fans, or it's a bad joke. I almost said apologies to Jackson, but you know. Our Cottrell College Science Award program, I just showed all the people that got awards under that program. It has been merged with our Cottrell Scholar Award program, and this is the first year of that merger. And that means that research universities and PUI faculty are all going to apply to the same program. And for this particular program, you apply in your third year from your first tenure track appointment, and you have one shot at this program. So in that sense, it's more restrictive, but the awards are larger. There are going to be 100,000 direct funding for everyone who gets an award under this program, so it's a substantial award for somebody at a PUI. And it requires both research and education. So if you applied under the Cottrell College, you just wrote a research plan. Under Cottrell Scholar, you write a research plan and an education plan. And it's important to think about being effective in both of them. We want to support the teacher-scholar model. That actually should be something that works well for PUI faculty. And then if you become a Cottrell Scholar, you're eligible for additional career advancement awards. And that's a nice additional opportunity. You're also part of the Cottrell Scholar community, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And then I'm going to move over to having you guys do some talking after this background.
Can you clarify what third year means?
Do you apply in the second year? What third year means is this is 2015, and so we had a pre-proposal in the spring of 2015, and we'll have a full proposal due at the end of the summer. And what we said is for 2015, anybody who had their initial faculty appointment in calendar year 2012 can apply. We just do it that way to make it simple, so we don't have to worry if somebody was, you know, started in July or they started in January or whatever. If your appointment was calendar year 2012, you were eligible to apply in our 2015 cycle. If your appointment was 2013 calendar year, you'll be eligible to apply for our next year, for 2016. And go ahead and look up these details on our website. We explain everything on all of that, so I don't, that's a good. For those kind of details, please look that up. So we're supporting innovative, transformative research. We're developing early career faculty. committed to both research and teaching, and I hope that's something that you guys are committed to. We want to build and sustain a community of teacher scholars, and so we've started, back in 2011, we started the Cottrell Scholar Collaborative, and this is a group of, basically anyone who's a Cottrell Scholar can participate. We hold an annual conference for Cottrell Scholars. We have all the new Cottrell Scholars come every year. We invite back older Cottrell Scholars, and we allow people to propose projects in which they can collaborate, where they can move forward significant education initiatives. So a couple of things that have emerged from that is a new faculty workshop, which has existed for years for the physics faculty, did not exist for chemistry. Cottrell Scholars have started collaborating with the American Chemical Society, a new faculty workshop for chemists, which has been extremely successful and actually has a little bit of a different emphasis than the APS AAPT workshop, because rather than physics education or disciplinary education researchers, the chemistry one has Cottrell Scholars as the people organizing and presenting a lot of the material, and so it's coming from the point of view of practitioners, and there is a certain advantage to that. There's also, you know, there's a lot of things presented. We've had a number of other projects, and actually we just published a book, and I forgot to bring copies of the book, so I really apologize. It's a book by Cottrell Scholars on how to teach better, save time, and have more fun. It's a great resource book. I strongly recommend that everybody here get a copy of it. You can get it for like $12 on Amazon. I was going to bring copies for everybody, and I didn't. I think you can also download a PDF of it for free, but it's nice to actually have the book, and I'll try in the future to get you guys for ANA-CAPA meetings copies of the book, because we want to distribute them. So that was a mistake on my part. Okay, so one of the things that we, just to finish up that last slide, actually, one of the things that we are very hopeful of by having both the undergraduate and the research university faculty is we're going to be bringing both of them together at our conferences. We're going to be hopefully encouraging the opportunity of collaboration between them, collaboration on research, collaboration on education, the ability for them to learn from one another, because we think both communities have things to offer. And I think both communities actually, from talking to people, are excited about the opportunity to interact in a meaningful way. And we want to build that strong collaborative. So that's part of the thinking for why we're merging these programs. Another big part of the thinking of why we're merging these programs is that we've seen tremendous success on the part of faculty at PUIs, and they are producing and being successful at the level that they can be full members of the Cottrell Scholar Collaborative, and we don't want to have the distinction anymore. We want to recognize everyone as outstanding teacher scholars for the best people that are successful with us. And we think it's a way to really support the colleges, and it benefits the people from the research universities as well. Okay, so one of the things I like to do before I get into talking about grant writing is I like to ask people to reflect for a couple of minutes on two things, and we'll start with one and then we'll do the other. The first thing I like to ask people to reflect on, and this is something where you could actually talk to the person next to you for a minute, what are the resources that a new faculty member is provided when they come on board? What resources does your institution provide? What did you get as a new faculty member, or what are you providing to somebody that you're going to hire? Just 2 or 3 minutes. You might even jot something down, but I think it's worthwhile to reflect on what are all the resources that institutions actually provide. What should they be providing? What are you providing? Take a moment and talk to the person next to you and see if you can come up with a short list of what those are. Thank you.
So that's a good answer.
Okay. Okay, let me get folks' attention back. So I want to hear from people what some of these things are. So just toss out some of the resources. What are the main ones? What are the big ones? Startup. Okay, so...
How much?
Right, that's a good question. And what I will say is that what we ask when people apply, you know, what's the size of your startup, and we've been tracking that. And I would say at PUI institutions now, what we're seeing is typically startup is greater than 50K. We've seen startup as high as 250K at a PUI. I would say that for theorists, it's typically not as large as for experimentalists. But I haven't broken down the averages on that.
Do you find a distinction between physics and chemistry and that sort of thing, or is it more just very much?
No, I don't think there's a big difference between physics and chemistry on the startup. I think to start a lab in either one has similar issues. A lot of times chemistry has some shared equipment that institutions have invested in. More so than physics, I think. But I think the days of startups, zero startup or almost zero startup, and being able to be effective and that there's a credible environment at your institution, that's a difficult case to make in the absence of startup.
Do you make that data available? It could be very effective to departments who are arguing when they hire someone to make their dean aware.
Right. We do try to make things, we certainly talk to people, but we haven't officially made that data available. So that's something to think about, whether we can do that. I don't know if we can do that or not. I have to think about that.
I would think even if there's a statement that says you are not a credible institution, if you don't provide startup funds at a certain level, we take some time. And I talked
right
there. With institutions that are reached very minimal on that
front. Right. We certainly make those, we have told people, you know, I've sat down with the dean, I've told them that, and chairs and whatnot. Okay, so what are some other resources, just quickly?
Release time from teaching.
Release time from teaching. What else? What are you?
Team support for summer students for the first couple of years.
Yeah. Other resources? Are there other resources?
Travel funds.
Travel funds.
Free pre-tenure sabbatical.
Pre-tenure sabbatical.
Lab space.
Lab space. All right, so, and I think we could think of some others. So there's a quick list, and it's obviously not exhaustive. So it's pretty clear that there's tremendous investment in a new faculty member. So two things. One, obviously, if institutions make a hire, they don't want somebody to fail, because it's really expensive and difficult. And two, this is a tremendous amount of resources, and the basic rule that we all know is that nobody gives you resources without expectations in return. So the second part of the exercise, which I think a lot of times junior faculty, sometimes senior faculty, are not very clear on, is what are the expectations for a new person when they have these kind of resources? So I think it's worthwhile, again, you guys spend just a couple minutes and say, what are the expectations at your institution when these kinds of resources are provided to a new faculty member? And if you're a junior faculty member pre-tenure, it would be really good to be very clear on this. So, go ahead. What are the expectations at your institution? Okay. So, what are the expectations that go along with these resources? Anybody, what are the expectations?
Nobel Prizes.
Nobel Prizes, okay.
In the first 5 years.
In the plural?
Yeah, there's only a few people that have won more than one Nobel Prize.
At my institution, we're expected to do research with students.
Okay.
With a certain sort of resources.
And what does it mean to do research with students?
Co-author
a paper?
Involve them in a way that they understand the physics and are participating in the research instead of just pushing knobs and running black boxes.
Okay.
Same at my institution, there is expectation of having students as authors on the paper.
Okay. Other expectations?
Above average teaching record.
Above average teaching record? Okay. So that's like Lake will be gone.
Yeah, Lake will be gone.
Yeah, all right. Other?
Grant money.
Grant money. So external funding. Other expect?
Publish?
I didn't hear anyone say that.
Publish in peer-reviewed journals.
Publish in peer-reviewed journals, okay. And oftentimes, it's pretty difficult to specify number of papers, but there's an expectation that there are going to be papers, probably more than paper, by the time you go up for tenure.
We are required to present, citation and impact statistics.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Wow. We are not.
Thank goodness for Google Scholar.
I would say also there are the expectations and then there's the desirables. So I think for us, there's sort of the formal list of what's expected and required for tenure would not include for, you don't have to get grants to get tenure. But it's certainly a good thing. And so I think it's there's a gradation within the expectations.
Right. And that kind of points to the fact that sometimes you can't say to somebody in a black and white way exactly what constitutes the case for tenure, but hopefully you can give really good direction, and hopefully the person who's going to go up for tenure has a very good concept of what's going to make a strong case.
Is it significant department or college service?
Right.
Along with teaching evaluations done by the students, there's required, and institutional research provides this for us, a comparison of our graded patterns with those of the average in our college and university as a whole. So we can't get tenure by enrollments.
All right, so let me quickly throw up some of the expectations I came up with. So you have to start writing proposals. And sometimes people argue that if you have a large startup, you can wait and get set up. It makes sense to do that. But I think in most places, especially given the funding climate, it makes sense to start writing proposal with an S, plural, early in your time at the institution. You have to set up your research. So, you know, for the experimentalists, they have to get their equipment, the computationalists, their clusters. Whoops. You guys have to get your chalk. Yeah, a lot of chalk. You got to involve students, like we were talking about. You got to revise your proposals in the second year because they didn't get funded the first year, right? You got to present your results. Early on, you have to start going to meetings. You have to start publishing your results. You have to renew your grants. You want to keep them going once you've gotten them, or move on to other funding sources. You got to engage in great teaching, and that's always contextual for an institution. But certainly at the PUIs, I think there's a very high bar for teaching compared to most institutions. And that's looked at very seriously at most PUIs. Service, somebody talked about. And let's see, you fly over the tenure bar at year six when you do all of this, right? Okay, so this is really the big picture expectation. Is that you're going to establish and maintain a productive, exciting, well-funded research program that involves students and flourishes for decades while simultaneously being a great teacher and then doing all the ancillary activities like service to your society and college and, you know, chairing your department and so on, right? Right. But that's really the expectation. So big part of that expectation, a huge part of that expectation, and I want to spend a little time where we come in is and other foundations like us is the whole grant external funding process. So let's talk about that for the little bit of the remaining time that I have. So again, take a minute and everybody decide what are the three most important things to do before writing a grant. Does everybody have their three? You have your three? Okay, so let's hear some ideas from folks. What are the three most important things? Tell me one. Everybody came up with at least one, right? So you go around the room even. What's one of the three most important things?
Get Red Bull. No, just kidding. Identify funding sources. I don't know how far back you want to go.
Sure. Some other ideas. We don't have to go all the way around the room. But
talk to the program officer.
Talk to the program officer, okay.
Read
somebody else's proposal. All right. What are some other ideas?
Preliminary data.
Preliminary data. Okay.
Have an idea about a plan as to how you might want to spend the money and how the project might evolve over a 3-year period.
Right. So actually conceptualize the project in terms of the context of how long it's going to be. I would comment on preliminary data. It depends on the program. We allow for our early career, we look at proposals that don't have preliminary data, but if you have that data, it can certainly strengthen it. What are some other things? Is that it? Everybody's now you're set to write the proposal?
You should have an idea of what you want to do.
Ah, yeah. An idea, a scientific idea.
Yeah, scientific idea.
Have someone who's more established take a look at what you have. Somebody sympathetic.
Right. Somebody sympathetic, and also maybe somebody not necessarily so sympathetic that's at least going to give you some very realistic feedback. Okay, other ideas of what to do, most important things to do before writing a grant? Yeah, make sure you have that lined up.
That's what I was going to say. Make sure they will actually put the grant in.
Okay. Right. Anybody else want to throw one out, or we're all prepared? Okay, I'll give you my three most important ones.
Location, location, location.
That's pretty close. Read the guidelines and the frequently asked questions for a program. Read the guidelines. And everything else that people said is right. You know, I'm just, you know, obviously saying this to emphasize that if you don't carefully read the guidelines, that is a huge mistake, because what you don't want to do is develop a project for a program that it doesn't fit the program. And also, you know, one of the things is that a lot of times you're doing multiple things, or you have different aspects of what you're doing, and if you're going to apply to us and we're looking for a basic science project, you don't want to necessarily emphasize the most applied aspect of what you're doing, because now you're writing to the wrong program and you might as well, you know, you're really not starting in the right place. And the thing is that somebody said talk to the program officer. I think that's a really good idea, but I think you do this first, because you know, you guys know what it's like, obviously. When your student comes in to ask you a question and they obviously haven't even taken a look at the material, it's disheartening. You know, you don't really feel like that person is going to have much of a chance. So if somebody calls me up and they ask me the first thing, where if you open up the program guidelines and it's the first line is the answer, I tend to feel like I'm not going to be spending my time in a valuable way, although I will be polite to you. I do feel that I can have a much better conversation with people if they've actually thought about the program and now they've started to think about the other kinds of questions maybe there's subtle issues that they want to address, or, you know, they want to explore some things, that's a fine, and I will do that, and I like to do that, and it really helps if you've carefully read the guidelines first. You can always call and ask why we're doing that, and, you know, why we've put that in there. You know, what really is a good way to fulfill that, you know, those kinds of things. And obviously, that's our website. Core idea, this is another good one. How do you select an idea to build a research proposal? So take a moment. How do you come up with a good core idea to build?
Wheeler did. What would Wheeler do? Yeah, actually,
that might not be good because you might not be able to do what Wheeler would do.
Yeah, right.
No. How do you select a core idea for a project? What's a good way to approach that? Okay, so how do people choose a good idea? What's a way to choose a good idea? What are you thinking about when you're thinking about putting together a proposal as to the core idea?
Well, obviously you build on what you know, and in talking with friends, collaborators, you have ideas. I typically bounce them off of others and say, I think this is reasonable, this is good. Somebody said, has it been done before? It's good to know. And I find something that as well that I think, maybe I can't always do it, but I think I can contribute in, I think, a meaningful way. May not be, somebody mentioned, the hottest topic in the field at the moment, but try to sell it as an important topic.
Okay. Others? Yeah.
Choose something feasible.
Mm-hmm. Any other? How do you guys choose your ideas? What would you tell somebody else if you were going to give them advice?
I mean, you should think about how it's being reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
Who the reviewers are.
Mm-hmm.
Me.
Mm-hmm.
You better be interested in it and want to do it. Not just right. Not just something that you think you can get funded, but that you actually that you want to spend your time executing.
I believe in that really strongly because the way I look at it is you're only going to be working on a couple of projects, and you might work on a project for a couple of years if you've been funded for it, and if you're not passionate about it, that's a real bummer. You're probably not going to do as good a job, and you also have said, I'm going to work on this for the next couple of years, so I think that's a really important criterion myself.
I was kind of joking, but I said, if you talk about the idea to people and they say, wow, that's probably a good core idea. And conversely, if they say, oh, that's too far out, that also could be a very good idea. I had a colloquium talk where Victor Weisskopf, after seeing this great talk, which was really the core idea for my research, said, well, what are you going to do for a living? Send me back 10 years. But I like the idea of getting some kind of communal feeling, including from who. What would reviewers do?
Right. I think that's extremely important. Anybody else want to share? This is a good time to tell people, because not only to help everyone here, but also to help your colleagues that you're going to be advising. What are you going to tell them?
Whatever's on your slide.
Also, I mean, if you plan to involve students in research, I mean, is that research feasible with students?
Right. Yeah.
In meaningful way.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important. At the PUIs and for theoretical physics, I think a bias that I've seen from reviewers and people are thinking about whether to fund theoretical physics at PUIs is the notion of whether undergraduates can meaningfully be involved in theoretical physics research. And I think there are people that believe that's not the case, that theoretical physics done at an advanced level is too advanced for undergraduates. And you probably can't just give them the counterexample of Heisenberg at 20, because that's not going to settle the case. I think what you can do, and I think one of the, something that's extremely important about the ANACAPA Society, in my opinion, is that you guys here have a ton of examples of meaningfully involving undergraduates in really high-quality projects that have led to papers, have led to really important advances, and you need to be able to describe how you did that effectively, and you need to mentor the young faculty that are coming up that are in theoretical physics for how they can do that and encourage them to be able to explain and convince others that it's doable. And you have the data, you have the anecdotal cases that are extremely persuasive. So how have you been effective in involving undergraduates? You have to share that with one another, because that is a bias that the theoretical physicists at undergraduate institutions have to deal with. I think it's completely, you can overcome it, but you should be aware of it, and you need to help one another do it. Let's see. Significance. So we want you to make a case of significance, and we can talk about all the intangible ways to do that, but I did like what you were talking about. I think the operational definition of significance that you should bear in mind is think about who the reviewers are going to be, and particularly I think a good way to think about it is who are the best people in your field, your area, and ask yourself the question, if they were to look at your idea, would they be excited about it? And the response that you want, you want to have an idea that the best people in your field would be looking forward to the outcome. They want to see the paper that results. They're like, I can't wait to see the PhysRev letter that comes out of this project. And if you think about it, if you think that the best people in your field would be very ho-hum about the idea, you probably haven't chosen something that's all that significant. Now, there's all sorts of other ways to think about significance. You can think about potential applications, even if it's basic research. I'm looking at the physics of bacterial cells in such a way that, you know, I'm coming up with a quantitative model for a process, but it may well lead to, you know, something that's going to, you know, allow a new approach to fighting bacteria. That was fantastic. If you can justify it, that's totally legitimate. That's one way to go for significance. How does it advance the field as a whole? All those sorts of things are relevant, but I also think there's that operational definition that's worth bearing in mind, because that's actually whether you're going to get funded or not. Originality. You got to make a case for originality, and I think one of the biggest things, particularly at PUIs, is that you don't want to look like you're a postdoc still for your former mentor. That's to show independence. If you are collaborating with a mentor, you really have the extra hurdle of demonstrating that this is an independent project that you own. The project shouldn't look like it's a continuation in an incremental fashion of what you've been doing. It has to step forward in an important way, and you have to show that you have that ownership of it, and it is your idea. And that's important. You have to think about it when you're thinking about collaborators, because often research is collaborative. We view that as very positive, but at the same time, you have to really be making it clear how you are the one that is the owner. And feasibility, because obviously if you have a great idea that's very significant and very original, but you can't do it, it wouldn't make any sense to give you money for it. Okay, and this whole idea of addressing your audience. You have to write to your audience, and that's why, for example, bringing up the issue that you might have an extra hurdle as a theoretical physicist at a PUI to be able to demonstrate that you can involve students, for example. That's something you have to think about if that's going to be part of your audience. When you go, when you read the program guidelines, you talk to the program officer, you can say, who's going to be evaluating this? How is the decision brought about? Who are actually the decision makers that I have to convince? Because then that starts to get into your mind of how you want to write it. You know, how jargon laden, that's usually not too good an idea, but how much do you have to put in depending on who it is that's actually making the decision? The other thing that I would say that, how many people have read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink? Has anybody read that here? Has anybody heard of him? Okay, 1%. Okay, well, Malcolm Gladwell, you know, you can argue pros and cons about him, but the book Blink was a book about decision making, and one of the things that he argues in that book is that experts have a tendency to make up their mind very rapidly. So they look at something and they immediately reach a decision, and that's very common because of the expertise they bring to it. So if you're submitting a proposal, let's say there's a one-page summary, and your one-page summary isn't very well written, or it's kind of, you don't get to the point, and it's not, you know, really selling the project, somebody might look at that and they immediately have made up their mind that they don't really want to fund that. Now maybe if they're a conscientious reviewer, they'll read the rest of the proposal, but then the whole time you have to convince them to change their mind. Or they might not even read the rest of the proposal because, you know, they're human. So you much rather have the case where you do the kinds of things where you have a real punchy beginning. You know, you really sell people on your idea. You have to think about the fact that you're writing beyond the good idea, that you're writing to try to make a really good impression. Grammatical errors are terrible. Poor sentence structure is terrible. Poor quality writing is terrible. All of that stuff, lack of details, lack of clarity, all of that stuff makes it very unlikely that you'll get funded. And so, you know, you might also say, we're not even talking about anything about science here. But I think it's really important to bear in mind that the whole enterprise of science is a human enterprise, the whole enterprise of getting funded, of people going through that process. So you have to take into account all those things. Okay. And I'm happy for anyone to make any comments on or add anything to that. Okay.
Does that mean that it would be helpful to engage whatever grant writing office you have, especially on that first page? I mean, it kind of cuts both ways because those people will not know your field.
Yeah.
They will know grammar. So sometimes we think we have very, very good help in Hampshire, but they don't really add much sometimes. And other people have terrible
right. Yeah, what do people think on that point?
Know your institution, Zan, and know the people there, and talk to the other science faculty to find out. I mean, we have someone right now that we want to get rid of. And just, you know, we've got other people who are great.
So talk to your colleagues.
Talk to your colleagues to find out to whom you should speak and how much you should listen.
Yeah, and I tend to think that rather than, I mean, you need to have a good cooperative relationship with the administration at your institution and the various things that they have the role to do, but I have a tendency to think that you're much better off going to colleagues, going to senior people and asking for them to read what you have, and getting good, honest feedback. You ask people to really critique it and tell you what's wrong with it in their opinion, because I think you're much better off hearing that prior to submitting than after you submit it. So,
I also think, I mean, I am obviously not a native English speaker, and I'm here for reasons that there are some in this room, that it's always good to give your proposal to someone I call an American, so they can check, go through my language and stuff.
Right. That's a particular hurdle. If you're a non-native speaker, then you need, and it, depending, if you have great, if you're very fluent and you're very confident, and you have that quality, because I know non-native speakers that are outstanding English writers, but it, Right. So if that's an extra hurdle you have, because you're held to the same standard as everybody else.
I will say also, just last week, one of the people who's not here this week was saying that their home institution grants officer had said certain things about what was important within the grant, and the rest of us at the lunch table said, no. And if that struck this person as wrong, we said, yeah, that's just flat out wrong. So there's also something to be said for talking to colleagues and talking to program officers who actually know the programs you're applying to.
Right. Yeah, and I think another good point that brings up is you don't want to just simply rely on one source of information. You're gonna talk to lots of different people. That's why actually I want people in the room to be sharing, because you're all a source of information that are gonna help one another and also be helpful to your other colleagues. And it's that collective wisdom that's more effective.
On that point, I would just add that I was the first person from our institution to ever apply to Troy Award. And the sponsored research people tried to put overhead on. I had to get a letter from you guys telling them you can't do that.
Right.
Believe me.
Yeah.
Right.
So I just read what the award says.
So, but that's the paradox, because those people are professional in what they do, but they have their own mission. And yet, when I heard what you said, it sounded like you want something of a sales pitch in that summary page. And we're bad. I mean, I'm not particularly bad, but.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case that you're bad at that. I think it varies, but I think it's a learnable skill. So you go, you know, there's all these faculty, there's all these senior colleagues who've been successful grant writers, so you have to go to them as your source. I would hesitate. I think that you have to communicate and see what you can get from your sponsored programs office, and that's going to vary. But the people that have the most wisdom probably are the people that have been successful in the programs. So you can also, another thing you can do is you can look through for our awards database and then identify people you know and communicate with them. We can't share the proposal, but they can share their proposal. So you can ask people that have been successful with our foundation or with other foundations if they would share their proposal with you, not just they're reading your proposal, but you can read successful proposals and see, well, what are other people doing? That's a really good thing to do. The other thing is to review, depending on the programs and whatnot. Now, most of you guys are probably in a position where I can use you as a reviewer, and there is a value in that. First, there's a value in that you're simply being part of the community, and that's contributing, and that's part of that service aspect. But also, that's a really excellent learning experience to go through the review process. Or even serve on a review committee as opposed to just one or two isolated proposals. But obviously that's more of a commitment. But you definitely learn a ton from doing that. I know a lot more about proposals after having read, you know, probably pushing, I have to estimate, but I'm sure I've read well over 1,000, maybe a couple thousand proposals now. So you get a different perspective. And you also, when you see the things that get proposals to fail, let me wrap up fairly quickly because I think I'm out of time, right? So I'll just put these things up, and I can share this slide, but you know, we have a statement of problem and significance. You got to put the science in context. You have to show knowledge of the field. You know, obviously proposals get shot down when they're missing key references. You need to include a clearly stated hypothesis or key idea so people really know what the main point of the whole thing is. You know, and you need to make a compelling case like we've talked about for significance and originality on the various things that we talked about there. And under the plan of procedure, this is where you make a case for feasibility. And, you know, I see many, many, many proposals fail because they come across as vague. There aren't any details. So nobody has any reason to believe that what the person is talking about it can be done or will be done because they haven't shown any detailed explanation of what they're going to do. Experimental projects that don't have a setup or an explanation of even what the equipment is that, you know, is going to be involved in the experiment or how the measurement is going to be made. That seems pretty vague. What happens if there's key points where the project might fail? this is relevant to you guys, certainly. Is there any alternative approach? If you say that you're going to do something better than has been done before, and you don't make a quantitative, at least order of magnitude estimate, you know, I'm going to improve the bounds on, you know, a certain parameter, well, what does that mean? Absence of a quantitative statement doesn't look good at all, because we're physicists. Show long-term goals and sustainability. You know, you need to make the case that you can involve students, attract future funding, or this type of project that has legs. It's not just a one-off simple calculation and you're done. It's part of a broader program that you're going to sustain. And I think, show your research program involves students, and particularly, like I say, for you guys in theoretical physics at undergraduate institutions, that's very important. And that's all I had to say. So, thanks. And I can, if you guys want, I can send you a copy of the talk.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah. So, this is a team, and I know there's been a lot of interactive questions during the talk, but if there are a couple of questions right now that anyone might have.
I actually have two questions. The first one is relatively easy, I think. What is your actual funding rate in terms of percentage of proposals that get funded?
Yeah, that has varied depending on the program. For the Cottrell College program, the funding rate has been anywhere from 20% to over 30%. In the Cottrell Scholar program, the funding rate has been lower, like closer to a little bit over 10%. Last year in the Cottrell Scholar program, which did not include Cottrell College, I think we had 94 applications and we made 15 awards. So that was a little bit higher. I actually would not be surprised if we are close to 20% on applications from PUIs for Cottrell Scholar, but I don't know yet. Because we haven't done it yet.
Okay, and second somewhat quick question is that based on the survey you took at the beginning, there were only, say, 20% of the room who was eligible for the within the first 3 years. I am not one. So my question is, do you have programs for people who are beyond their first 3 years of a tenure track faculty position?
Yes and no. So for people that become Cottrell Scholars, we are now adding some career advancement opportunities. And I didn't spend a lot of time going into that because that information on those opportunities are on our website. And I don't know that there's anybody here that's a Cottrell Scholar. So, but if you become a Cottrell Scholar, there's an advantage there. We also have another program, which actually is part of the reason why I'm here today, and that's a program that we call SCILOG, which is short for Science and Dialogue, and that's a program that we've been running where we pick a topic. We've done solar energy conversion. We were doing the intersection of theoretical physics and physical cell biology, and we're now also going to be doing one on time domain astrophysics, and we identify relatively early career to mid-career people for this, the one that we're doing on time domain astrophysics. It's anyone who started from 2006 to the present, and we look in that category of people and with the help of various experts identify people that we think would be appropriate folks to come to that conference, and we by invitation invite people to apply. And people actually come to the conference and they compete at the conference for funding in a kind of, you know, real TV sort of way that's not
reality
TV. Thank you. That's what I meant. Not real TV. Reality TV. That's what.
Trump's funny.
Yeah, right. I have to wear like a Trump wig. And it's extremely embarrassing. So it is possible that if we're doing a topic in an area that, you know, you're in, that we might identify you. Certainly if you saw that there was something we were doing and you thought it fit, you could certainly contact me and we would consider whether that's appropriate. So we do have that program, and that's actually we've had a lot of interesting things happening with that program, but since it's more, it's by invitation, you know, I can't say that you can just apply for it.
I have a question I guess I want to ask in public. How would your list of the number of people from perusing our speakers that have had awards was amazing.
I thought it was, I was pretty pleased.
Me too. How would you advise us to take advantage of your next to the last remark here during the thing of sharing successful proposals, because all those people, one of them twice, had successful proposals to your program. Would it be okay to let everybody know that this is the list?
Oh yeah, well that's in my talk, that's in my...
In the slides.
In the slides.
But beyond that, could we actually ask those people, would you be willing to share your successful proposal with others in the Anacapa Society?
Well, you don't need my permission to ask them for their permission. I think it would be very relevant. I think it's a little bit different, not very much different in terms of the Cottrell Scholar Program. The type of thing that we're looking for a research plan is very similar. So in terms of the research plan, it would be very relevant. Now there's the whole question of the education plan, and we put education plans up, examples, by permission. We do put some examples because that's the one thing that people aren't very used to doing is writing education plans. And now part of the problem is we don't have education plans for PUIs, and we're not exactly sure what we're going to get for education plans for PUIs. We're going through the process right now. But one of the things that we're very conscious of is what works as a good education plan in one institution is not appropriate for another institution. So we judge things contextually, and what we are looking for is ways that people can make a real significant impact on their institution. So what we don't want is a routine plan. I'm going to develop a course, I'm going to teach, you know, quantum mechanics, and I'm going to do a really good job teaching quantum mechanics, and you know, I'm gonna make my lectures really, really clear so everybody's gonna understand it, because I'm gonna be more clear than other people. That's probably not gonna be a successful education plan, although I have seen that education plan. I've seen people. Well, it is a good thing to do. I've seen people say I'm a real traditionalist and I just believe in a chalkboard and a piece of chalk and a talk, and you know, I think we've been a foundation that's been very supportive of the types of gains that have been made from physics education research, implementing effective pedagogy with demonstrated learning outcomes. You know, we're certainly persuaded that there are methods of teaching that are much more effective than the traditional lecture method. The question is, what's happening at your institution? What would make a difference at your institution? I think there's tremendous opportunities for PUIs to bring forward really interesting education plans that would have an effect at their institution and would be something that you'd want to disseminate and would have an effect at other institutions and will influence what's going on at research universities as well. So I really think this is a tremendous opportunity for the young faculty that are going to apply to Cottrell Scholar to really be recognized as leaders.
Would your review panels know a lot about that?
Yes. They would. We have members on from the PUI committee community on our advisory committee, and there are also a lot of people that we ask for review that are very familiar with education issues, and the people from the research universities that are on our advisory committee also have a lot of knowledge and understanding of PUIs, because that's something that we look for before we put somebody on our committee.
Maybe this is a good time to pause. Richard's around the rest of today and also
all day tomorrow.
All day tomorrow. If you have other questions for him, obviously you can talk to him. But maybe we should stop now. Thank Richard. Have cookies in about 5 minutes.
Right. All right. Well, thank you guys.